All right, so we'll start. Hi, everybody. My name is Dave Smith. I'm sure some of you know of me. Happy to be here again. Want to thank y'all for inviting me back. And, of course, thank Chris for including me in his teaching work. And you guys are supposed to be in a new center by now. Is that true? Would you be in there by now if things were different? Most likely, yeah. Well, someday. Until then, here we are. So my name is Dave Smith. I'm a Dharma teacher, amongst other things. And I'm a longtime friend of Chris. Chris and I practiced and trained together, actually, with Against the Stream, the now no longer Against the Stream. Him and I have always been close and always remain close throughout all of the ups and downs of that scenario. I guess what I usually like to do, I know that we have an hour and a half, is I'll just talk for a little bit and do an introduction to the theme or the topic this evening, which is going to be on concentration, a very probably perspective on concentration that you might not be familiar with. I'll set that up a little bit. We'll do a practice. I'll do a guided practice that will correlate to the talk. I find that that's always helpful. And then I'll do a talk, and then we'll have some time to have some dialogue or some questions and maybe some answers. I can't guarantee that I'll have answers for you, but I will try. So where to begin here? So this is what's been on my mind, and this is the way that I've been using concentration in a way that I believe is skillful. One of the definitions, when you look at the Buddhist teachings on mindfulness, which is also known as Satipatthana, I'm sure some of you have come across the Satipatthana work. There's a lot being said and written about Satipatthana in the last decade or so. And in one of the definitions of Satipatthana, one of the definitions that I think is the most helpful is it's a very explicit instruction that the Buddha gives to put aside our desires and discontents in regards to the world. And so when we sit and we practice and we cultivate this inner quality of calm, of ease, of presence, of awareness, of all these kind of subtle Buddhist mental state qualities, and that one of the prerequisites to do that is we actually have to put aside, to some degree politely, I think, our desires and discontents about the world. And the world here, not meaning the world of the five senses, not the world of the aggregates or the sensory experience, but the world in the human world in which we all live, that is really out there, the world in which is out there, in which we all live, that world. And I don't know about you, but I'm having a hard time putting aside my desires and discontents in regards to the world lately. I have a lot of thoughts and feelings about how things should be. I mostly have a lot of discontent. I have a lot of discontent in regards to the world right now. And when I close my eyes and I sit down and I bring my awareness inward to my body, to my breathing, it shows up. And so I really think right now is a really interesting time to really take this teaching seriously. And so what happens if we can do this little event, this is the kind of concentration I think that we're looking for. Unfortunately, which is often the case in Dharma practice, as I'm sure many of you are aware, the English translations that we end up with from the original Pali, they oftentimes don't work so good. You know, dukkha as suffering, not really so good. Concentration is one of the ones I think that's really the most problematic, because Buddhist concentration, if you will, and we'll talk about the two various forms of that, there's samatha concentration and then there's samadhi, which is kind of the one to be more aware of, because samadhi is the same concentration that we want in the Eightfold Path. So it's really what we're looking for. But the word concentration doesn't imply calmness to me. Buddhist concentration is a calmness of mind, an ease of mind, a non-reactivity of mind, a presence, a quality that's maybe hard to come by. But when I think concentration in the English language, I don't think relax. I think actually alert and hypervigilance and pin the object down and trying too hard. So for those people who find that to be the case, I like to talk about the experience of samadhi, which is a quality of mind that might be more likened to be called like something like collectedness, where we're actually collected. It doesn't mean or imply at all that there's a single object that we're paying attention to. And I find this to be very helpful because I actually believe I have really good samadhi. I have really good collectedness, but I don't have good one-pointed concentration. My samatha is not great. My sabhati is really, really good, but they're both concentration. So it gets confusing. So like for me, if I was going to just put my attention on like something like my breathing in and breathing out and ignore everything else, I would have a really hard time doing that. I wouldn't get relaxed. I would get agitated. And I've been, and that's been the case for me for 3.5 decades. So no lack of trying, I can assure you. But being aware of a multiple range of experience without getting pulled into my desires and discontents in regards to the world creates a kind of samadhi, a collectedness, which is, I think, the experience in which the Buddha is trying to articulate when he talks about right concentration, is that kind of experience. And really what it is, actually, is it's not about being focused on a single object. It's about being able to resist the tug of distraction. It's not about the single object. It's about I can feel my attention wanting to think about the political landscape, wanting to think about the climate, wanting to think about a whole range of things. I can feel that tug, you know that tug? But I can resist that tug, right? And that's collectedness. It's actually, it's not so much about finding an object and pinning it down, which is a lot of us think about it that way. It's about being able to resist the pull of objects that are unsuitable. Distraction, confusion, anger, fear, the objects that want to kind of pull us out of our direct experience. Say, you know, you really should be worried about this, and you really should be worried about that, and you really should be thinking about this, and you really just shouldn't be sitting here in your office on the floor meditating right now. This is like really irresponsible. There's so many other things that you should be doing right now. You want to be able to resist that. And if you can do that, that creates a samadhi type of what I would probably call Buddhist concentration, where this actually, it's not really about the object, but it's about the objects in which you're not getting seduced by, we could say. Does that make sense? It's a whole different way of looking at this. So it's not so much what I'm paying attention to, it's about what I'm not getting sucked into. Right? So that flips the kind of script on it a little bit. And so we'll do a practice on this and I'll talk more about it. So the object that we pay attention to can be variable. So when I practice this kind of practice, I'll notice a multiple range of objects, or what we might call in neuroscience, which is actually a term that I like, called metacognitive awareness, which means that I'm understanding and I'm aware. There's meta meaning multiple. There's lots of things going on. And I'm choosing, not so much what I'm paying attention to, but I'm also choosing what I'm not paying attention to. So we might use breathing in and breathing out. We might use, I use temperature a lot, feeling the air on the temperature on my skin. We might use the weight of the body in the chair. We might use background sounds. The object might change from moment to moment experience. That's okay. Because what that does is that creates what my good friend Cheryl Sleen and Tejaniya talks about, is a continuity of mindfulness. So that's really what we want to have, is continuity of mindfulness leads to samadhi. So this trying to pin down the single object, which is nothing wrong with pinning down a single object, if that's what you do, that's fine and good. But that's, you don't have to do that. We want that continuity of awareness. And so what we want to try to do is to pay attention and bring our awareness into a multiple range of what's happening within our somatic domain, which is the word I like to choose. I use the word somatic instead of body because it actually gives us a more liberal view. It gives us the five senses. It gives us temperature. It gives us gravity. It gives us sensations of the in and out breathing. Our somatic domain is actually quite large. Right? So we can, as long as we're in that domain of experience, the objects that come and go where our attention goes might change a little bit, but we'll still get that continuity. And then we'll get that kind of Buddhist concentration, which is a sense of being relaxed, being alert, being present, being at ease, and being in the mind, that the mind of non-distraction is really the key, I think, here. I can feel the distraction knocking at the door, but I can still stay within my somatic domain. Does that make sense? So I want to do this with you because I think this is a practice that doesn't really get offered so much. And we'll try it out, and then we can have some questions about that, and I can talk a little bit more about this, about how you can actually use this putting aside your desires and discontents in regards to the world as an actual concentration practice and as an inner refuge in a form of what I might call mental seclusion, where we can retreat to our inner experience when we feel, a whole range of feelings about the world, in which you can't live in all the time, as I'm sure you know. It can become very unhealthy. So what's the relevance, I think, of concentration within the goal of Satipatthana, which the goal is to develop and maintain awakening factors. So to develop mindfulness and investigation and energy and joy and concentration and contentment and equanimity, all these subtle experiences. Concentration has a role, but it's not the end sum game. And one of the things to think about here, I think, especially with like samadhi as concentration. So samadhi as a collectedness. Samadhi, a concentration without an object, if you can get it behind that idea. Where samatha, meditation, is one object concentrated on the object, the mind wanders back to the object. That's samatha, that's also known as concentration. But what I like to say, the good concentration is the samadhi concentration, which is the collectedness. And so it's actually understood that, and this is true with all good qualities. So we could say concentration, we could say generosity, we could say kindness, we could say mindfulness, all these kind of wholesome mental qualities, these wholesome chittas, is that actually when you're abiding or dwelling or resting in mindfulness, the abiding is actually the attaining. Because a lot of times we can get into this habit as practitioners where we actually are abiding, but then we have this feeling, I don't know if you have this feeling, the feeling of waiting for something to happen when you're sitting. Okay, I'm doing it. Like we want the thing of it. Where is the thing of it? We want some kind of an attainment. Perhaps we might think about it. But ironically, the abiding and the attainment are kind of they're the same thing. They're like the seed and the fruit. And so the thing that's so hard when we think about hindrances, one of the hindrances that needs to fall away is actually kind of that craving or that attachment of like, I'm here, I'm present, but I'm thinking it should have a little bit more something. I'm wanting the experience to be more, to be better, to be, we kind of put that, this is why I don't like the term enlightenment as a dharmic goal, because this is where I actually don't like Buddhism, for example, is because they've taken the goal of Dharma practice to be an awake human being, and it's been elevated to this enlightenment status, that it's become this thing that like nobody could ever achieve. I think that's gotten pretty far away from the original message, which is why I'm a little bit dare I say, I'm a little bit of a fundamentalist in terms of really kind of keeping it in the early Buddhist tradition, because the more we look at the early Buddhist tradition, we start to see that the experience of awakening, being awake, the experience of Nibbana, the experience of the third noble truth of Nirodha or cessation, is actually not really that profound or very mystical, actually, I don't believe. And so I believe that many of us, probably many of you, are having these kinds of experiences, maybe more than you recognize, but it's almost as if we have to learn how to pay attention to that. That's that kind of ordinary awakening. There's if you're interested, there's a talk on Dharma Seed, a recent talk on Dharma Seed from a teacher named Stephen Batchelor, who some of you might be familiar with, called Nibbana is for Everyone. And it's a really, really great talk because he's actually really unpacking this idea that I'm talking about in a very kind of Batchelor-esque way, which is just overly detailed and educated. And but really, and it also comes from a Buddha Dasa, it comes from a Thai monk who wrote a pamphlet in the late 70s called Nibbana is for Everyone. And this idea that the dharmic goal, if you will, is not the attainment of a state, but actually the presence of a kind of quality that really comes and goes. And so it's become, the whole goal has become so state driven. You know, I don't know about you, but I've suffered from this delusion. I've been somebody who's been at this for a long, long time, that I'm going to practice well, I'm going to go on retreats, I'm going to sit, I'm going to study, I'm going to do all the stuff we're supposed to do. And then there's going to be like some event, right? Something's going to happen. And on the other side of that event, it's going to be easy for me. I'm going to be all good. Do you have this in your mind? Have you given up on this one yet? Or you have it? You have it, right? It's like, and what happens is it almost is buying insurance that it will never happen, because actually we're missing the kind of perspective that we're trying to gain here. And so this, and actually a lot of this is obtained really by the moment-to-moment experience of the daily practice. I find, and I'm finding it to be very true right now, in the current circumstances, of putting aside my desires and my discontents about the world. Because doesn't take very long for me to feel like the world is crumbling and the shit is hitting the fan. And, you know, and I don't know if that's true. This might be this might be the dark night of the soul. This might be that kind of thing. We might be coming into an era of really massive transformation as a race. I don't know that everything's fucked right now. At times I'm pretty convinced that it is, but that's just my own delusion. That's just my own internal frame. That's just my own view. And it changes. I don't know about you, but like since this COVID thing, and as I watch my mind throughout the day, it changes vastly. I have moments where I think we're going to be okay. I have moments where the sky is falling. I mean, I just can't even keep up. And I don't know which one to trust. So I choose to trust none of them. And I choose to trust that actually the best thing I can do right now is to sit and to practice and be with my family and, you know, grow vegetables and have chickens, which is what we're doing, and just really like, you know, I'm freaking out. I'm like, well, I'm freaking out about the world. Maybe I'll just like do the dishes. You know, maybe I could actually do that. That would be good. So it's really, I almost feel like I'm living in a monastery. And I think a lot of us feel that way because you're at your home. You're at your home a lot. And, you know, me and my wife have been trying to treat our day-to-day experience as if we're at like IMS and like with the rigid schedule, you know, and it's been actually really kind of nice. And it's really done a number because I can't go out and I can't do that much. It's really allowed me to wake up to how much distraction I was living in before, and actually how much I, to some degree, enjoy being totally distracted. You know, because distraction's one of those things that we can kind of make a derogatory attitude about, but we're actually, a lot of times when we are distracted, we like it. It feels good. It also allows me, if I'm highly distracted, it allows me to avoid any emotional undertone of things that are going on that I don't really want to feel right now or I don't want to address. So distraction is a kind of poor man's medication. It kind of allows us to avoid some stuff that's really actually probably needs to be addressed. And it's this kind of concentration that I'm talking about that really is saying, actually, I'm gonna choose to not doom scroll and look at the, you know, news, and I'm really just gonna try to be present for myself or my kids or whatever your scenario is. And you know, if there's one thing people aren't doing, is they're really not sitting quietly trying to cultivate this inner peaceful experience. The world will probably benefit much better from you doing that than all the other things you think that you could or should be doing. So we are on this kind of all in this, you know, meditation retreat. It's kind of how I feel about it right now. And I have so many desires and discontents in regards to the world that it's at times overwhelming. So when we think about, I guess part of my message here is if you can, is try to think about, because we're stuck with this word concentration and meditation practice. We're not going to get a better word. We're stuck with it. But trying to maybe have a more liberal view on concentration. And just trying to see ways in which you can not be so concerned about the object in which you're focusing on, but actually the objects in which you're not getting sucked into. You know, I think that's a bit, for me, that's been a much more skillful frame, because a lot of times I can be doing that metacognitive thing where I'm like actually being aware of multiple things that actually feel good and they feel wholesome and they feel doable, and I don't have to be so dictated by that single kind of single pointed concentration, which is, for some reason, I don't want to try to pull anybody, I don't want to scapegoat anybody here, but I don't know where that came from, because I know that for me, for sitting at IMS and a lot of that, the Insight World tradition, there was a lot, for long periods of time, there was a lot of emphasis on just being with a single object and that actually being sort of super, super important. But it's not really so much mentioned in the earliest forms of that we find in the canon. It's more, I think, of a lineage kind of thing. Maybe it's a Burmese lineage thing, which I think is great. I love the tradition of the Sayadaws of Burma. But sometimes these practices, we have to realize, were designed and developed by people who were monastics. They put aside their desires and discontent for the world a long time ago. They don't pay taxes. They don't deal money. They don't deal with money. They don't have sexual relationships. They don't, you know, they don't have a Netflix and a Hulu and a, you know, they don't have all the crap that you have. So they're much more suited for that kind of stuff than say maybe we are. So when we cultivate qualities, whether it's concentration or even like, for example, metta practice can be a concentration practice. But it's not so much that we're trying to concentrate on the phrases. We're really actually trying to see if we can feel or to abide or to just acknowledge an internal quality of basic goodness, an intention of ease, of harmlessness. And that's maybe it. And then we can like let our minds absorb into that. And then we can dwell in that. And then the dwelling again in the abiding is actually the attaining. You're actually, that's really where the cultivation happens, is you're over periods of time, you're in that experience, which means you're going to have more access to it later. For example, on a secular side of things, there was a book that I really, really enjoyed that came out maybe a couple years ago now called Altered Traits. And it was written by Dan Goleman and Richard Davidson, who are two, first of all, long, long time meditators. you know, they were at the Goenka retreats in the 60s with Joseph and Jack and all those folks. They were all part of that world. They just went, they went science, but they're all hardcore meditators. But there's this theory that they came up with that they unpack in the book called the after becomes the before for the next during. So I can unpack that a little bit for you because it sounds exciting when you hear it. It's not that profound, but it, but then again, maybe it is. So if I am, let's just use concentration as the frame. So if I am developing moment-to-moment concentration as I do in practice, and after my meditation, I feel more at ease. I feel more Buddhist concentration. I feel relaxed. I feel alert. I feel present. I feel at ease. So that after becomes the before. So the next time I go to meditate, I'm more likely to have that experience again during my sit. So the after becomes the before for the next during. And kind of that's how it cycles through. Now that's also true with concentration. It's also true with mindfulness. It's also true with metta, loving kindness, compassion, gratitude, all these sort of Buddhist qualities we talk about. The cultivation process for all of those happens the same way. So again, and that's also does play into the science of death, actually what neuroplasticity is. It's that, so this is why, and I mentioned this last time I talked to y'all, this is why we have to be careful we don't get into this problematic game of trying to evaluate our meditation practice while we're practicing it. You know, like we're doing metta practice for 20 minutes and we're just checking in every other second. How's it going? I don't feel the metta. Where's the metta? I don't feel the metta. I'm not, you know, we get kind of in that evaluation game. But part of it is to just trust that the putting the energy forward, putting the view and the intention forward is going to pay off at some point down the road. Meaning the after of that is going to become the before. And that's actually how this abiding in these things becomes the attaining of these things. And as the book says, altered traits, is they start to have trait-like qualities. And then, you know, generosity can become a trait, or we would say maybe a habit. And so that's really, when we think about cultivation, which is my preferred term for meditation because it's more accurate, that's the kind of thing that we want to start to maybe consider or to think about more, rather than trying to constantly barrage ourselves with evaluating or checking in on how it's going. But actually really to, and I think there's an element actually of trust here, or even an element of blind faith, that at times I have many times during my practice have had to be like, I don't really know if I buy any of this stuff, but I'm going to do it anyway. Like, I've been doing this metta thing for a while and I just ain't feeling it, man. And whether I'm feeling it or not is not the barometer to be using. I mean, you know, that's, and it's so hard to break this. I was talking to one of my students last night about this, of like how hard it is to overcome the whole pleasure pain dichotomy. Of just like, you know, I'm not feeling it, so it's not working. And, you know, we have to get, as we know, as practitioners, we do want to get a better measuring stick than Vedana, than just whether it feels pleasant or unpleasant. That's the thing that gets us in all the trouble to begin with anyway. So a lot of times it's just a matter of, and this on Bradley's question, this is kind of another way to look at it, is this is really where investigation can be good in terms of investigating our resistance towards some of these practices, or our not wanting to, or being working on that. Because anybody who's given some time to this practice, we know that somewhere deep in our value system, we trust and we know that this is good stuff and we should be doing it. So when there's resistance, we can investigate that and try to understand that that resistance doesn't probably come from a good place, or it doesn't come from a core place. And that kind of investigation can be really, really skillful. Like, yeah, like, why am I not doing what I know I should be doing. You know, and I don't want to meditate and exercise and eat broccoli, right? I want to eat junk food and sit around, you know? I mean, but I'm neurobiologically wired that way. It's not my fault. But, you know, I talked about this last time about effort. We have to understand that resistance training is much of the path. You know, like if people who go to the gym and work out, like if you need to build a muscle, you know, an actual muscle in your body, you know, the good trainer will tell you to do some resistance training. And I think a lot of what we do here is very much resistance training. It's sitting, feeling discomfort, feeling resistant, and staying with it. But trying to come at it with a little bit more compassion and kindness rather than turning it into a kind of, you know, sport-like thing. But we all have to navigate that kind of thing on our own. So I'm going to leave you with that.